Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host for this evening, Ethan Elkind. When was the last time that you got a solid 8 hours of sleep? Not too long ago, functioning on minimal sleep was a point of pride for many individuals, a sign of toughness and a drive to succeed. And indeed, it seems to remain the status quo. Last year, the Centers for Disease Control published a study showing that over one-third of American adults are not getting enough sleep on a regular basis, raising their risk of health issues and resulting in major losses in productivity. But even if we aren't logging more hours of rest, there seems to have been a shift in attitude about sleep recently, perhaps even a sleep revolution. Tech employees who used to brag about how little shut-eye they received are now downloading sleep apps and taking a snooze in company nap rooms. Entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley are betting that sleep is a new health fad, investing time and money to develop devices they claim will monitor and improve the quality of our rest. How important is sleep to our health? And will these new technologies really help us get a better night's sleep? To discuss these issues and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio tonight by Liz Rocket, a director with Kaiser Permanente Ventures, where she focuses on investments in healthcare IT, digital health, and technology-enabled services. Prior to joining KP Ventures, Liz ran the health practice at Imprint Capital, advising foundations and endowments on healthcare investments that aligned with their mission interests. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you can be here. And joining us by phone, we have Dr. Cleet A. Kushida, a neurologist, professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, medical director of the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, and director of the Stanford Center for Human Sleep Research. Dr. Kushida has conducted basic and clinical sleep research since 1977 and has founded and presided over numerous sleep associations. Welcome, Dr. Kushida.
Thank you.
Glad you can join us. And we are also joined by phone by Nancy Rothstein, known as the Sleep Ambassador and Director of Circadian Corporate Sleep Programs. Nancy consults and lectures on sleep science and sleep optimization strategies to Fortune 500 companies, the travel industry, universities, schools, and other organizations. Nancy serves on NIH Sleep Disorders Research Advisory Board and on the steering committee of myapnea.org. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Glad you can join us. And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We're going to open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes, and you can reach us then by dialing 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you want to contact us right away, though, you can email or text us right now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at CityVisionsKALW. Are you having trouble getting a good night's sleep? We want to hear your thoughts on this topic, so please do reach out. So, Dr. Kushida, I wanted to begin with you as our resident health expert on the subject, and I'm curious to know what exactly defines a good night's sleep.
Actually, what it is more the consequences of poor sleep. So the amount of sleep is really determined by not only the quantity of sleep, but also the quality of sleep. So if you don't have a good night's sleep, oftentimes what happens is the next day you feel very sleepy, and consequently you might have problems with driving and performing at your peak levels. So, you know, when we evaluate patients, typically we ask about their quantity of sleep, their quality of sleep, but also the impact of the sleep on their daily life.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, what are the impacts on their health if they're not getting a good night's sleep?
Yeah, so besides the risk of motor vehicle accidents and work-related accidents, they also can have mood changes. Oftentimes what happens is if they already have a history of depression, sleep deprivation can actually lower the threshold for depression, so it can make them more predisposed to having episodes of depression. In addition, anxiety disorders also have increased frequency of those that are sleep deprived, as well as issues like, for instance, related to blood pressure. You can have increases in blood pressure and heart rate and make you more predisposed down the road for things like heart attacks and stroke. In addition, we all know that if you don't have a good night's sleep, oftentimes your memory is impaired. In addition, attention and vigilance, being able to focus at work, is obviously impaired. And then it also has an impact on what we call higher order functions. So the ability to do to perform complex activities like driving is affected.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost a public safety problem then, to an extent, if you have people who aren't getting enough sleep and operating heavy machinery or doing other activities that might harm the people around them. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's highly prevalent. Even when you think about it, about 1/6 at least of the of Americans have been identified as having poor sleep on a frequent basis. And that's not counting the 80 or so other different sleep disorders.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kushida, just staying with you, you talk about poor sleep. What are some of the common complaints that you hear from people that would sort of define a poor night's sleep?
So some of the things are difficulty falling asleep, frequently taking more than about 30 minutes to fall asleep, and then also frequent interruption in sleep and not being able to fall back asleep within 20 to 30 minutes. Those are some of the more common things, but we also look at things like, for instance, unusual behaviors during sleep, like sleepwalking, night terrors. In addition, a very common condition like obstructive sleep apnea, where the person has these interruptions in their breathing patterns during sleep and consequently is very sleepy during the day. These are the more common things, but there's also circadian rhythm problems where a person isn't able to fall asleep when desired, either delaying their bedtime or advancing their bedtime and getting up really early.
Mm-hmm. And is there a typical profile, the person who might suffer from these kinds of sleep issues?
It depends on the condition. For instance, sleep apnea, about 30 to 67% of the people that have sleep apnea are overweight as defined by a body mass index of 25 or greater. That's a characteristic of the disorder, but they can also have things like a enlarged tongue or a smaller than normal lower jaw that also may predispose them to having sleep apnea. But that's just one of the disorders that has these type of characteristics. The different disorders have different profiles, for these conditions.
Well, and sleep apnea has been in the news recently. The actress Carrie Fisher, who died on after a plane flight back from London to L.A., the doctors listed sleep apnea as one of the causes of her death, or helped contributing to it, along with a lot of drug use, unfortunately. But can you talk a little bit, for listeners who are unfamiliar with sleep apnea, kind of what it is and what the effects of it might be and how to treat it?
Yeah, so sleep apnea affects about 24% of men between the ages of 30 and 60, and about 9% of women. These are these populations have demonstrated sleep study evidence of having sleep apnea. Basically, what sleep apnea is the upper airway repetitively closes during sleep, and we don't exactly know why that occurs, but we think things like excessive weight, as well as I mentioned, formation of the upper airway can lead to that. And because of this closure during sleep, what happens is the person has tiny micro awakenings throughout the night that lead to the daytime sleepiness. And oftentimes a person that has sleep apnea might not even be aware that they have it, other than having loud disruptive snoring. And sometimes the bed partner might report that they have these gasping, choking sounds. But the most reliable indication of that they have this apnea is that they're very sleepy during the daytime. And so if a person is very sleepy, this is one of the things that we look at or one of the diagnoses we consider when they present to our clinic.
And just quickly, what's the common treatment then for this disorder?
There's basically three different treatments. One is CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure. It's basically a mask that goes over the nose connected to air pump that basically pushes air into the nose, prevents the airway from closing. There's upper airway surgery that actually works on either the soft tissue and or the bony structures of the upper and lower jaws to displace them forward to open up the airway. And another treatment is the oral appliance, which is basically a mouth guard or retainer that moves the lower jaw forward.
Mm-hmm. So at least there are some options then for people who suffer from that. Nancy Rothstein, I wanted to go to you, the sleep ambassador. Yes. What do you see in your line of work in terms of the impact that people not getting enough sleep has, both on them and, let's say, on their environment around them in terms of the people they interact with at work or at home or otherwise?
Well, I see constantly that people are starting to recognize that the way that they're living this 24/7 complete constant activity, including being on all kinds of devices before bed, isn't sustainable. People are wired, they're tired, And they're finding that they just can't keep up this pace. I see it at corporations, everything from, you know, people who work supposed normal hours to people who work shift work. I see it in executives. I see it in young people, all ages, because everybody's just, it's taken some time for people to start to feel the impact that they just can't keep up this pace. And I like to say that our biology hasn't changed, our behaviors have. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is, and I'm sure we'll be talking about some of these devices and some of these technologies to help us sleep, but at the end of the day, and I guess pun intended, it's really no one can sleep for you but you. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody has to take into their own hands if they, you know, and Cleet's just been addressing very well sleep disorders. And so you might have a sleep disorder that's undiagnosed and untreated, and no matter how good your sleep habits are, that's still going to be an issue until it's recognized and treated. At the same time, other people who don't have a bona fide sleep disorder, be it insomnia, restless leg syndrome, or sleep apnea, for example, or narcolepsy, the most common ones, they have what I like to call disordered sleep, which is irregular bedtimes, being on technology all the time, all-nighters for students, poor eating and drinking habits, having caffeine too close to bed. And it all affects what we were programmed to do. So I am seeing a big, that's why we're having this conversation, because people, you know, who can, nobody can solve your sleep problems for you but you, unless it's a sleep disorder and you need medical attention.
Well, it sounds like your thesis then is that technology in a lot of ways has created a lot of this disorder. And I'm curious if you've kind of looked into the history of sleeping. In other words, you know, we live in a very different type of lifestyle, certainly here in the developed world with electricity and now with all these mm-hmm. smartphone devices. I mean, what are our bodies sort of wired to do that, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years when we didn't have these technologies, you know, how did we sleep back then and how has that changed now by technology?
Well, we're hardwired to the 24-hour rotation of the Earth, and it's really our sleep-wake cycle is about light and dark. And what we did, you know, thank you, Thomas Edison, and even before that, a little before that, gas lamps, but thank you, Thomas Edison, and thank you to all these beautiful screens we've got, but it's brought, you know, day into night. And so we have thought we were adapting to this new way of functioning, and we can't, because our bodies just crave consistency. They crave, although we could talk about the way people used to sleep, and there were little changes about that in terms of our, you know, we go to sleep at night, we wake up in the morning. You know, centuries ago, people woke up late, you know, they went to bed when it got dark, early to bed, early to rise, but they may have awakened during the night and had various activities. But the way we function now, we're just stretching ourselves to the limit, and sleep took a back seat. And I think what's starting to happen and why we're seeing so much of a proliferation of anything to help us sleep, and can Silicon Valley solve that, really boils down to that we need to improve our sleep habits.
Mm-hmm. Well, Liz Rocket, on that note, what is Silicon Valley doing? You're involved in this work in terms of investing in new technologies. What are you seeing the Silicon Valley sort of responding with technology to address some of these issues?
Yeah, and I think, as Nancy was saying, we are seeing a lot of innovation coming from the technology space, but also really from the cultural space. And I'm excited to hear Nancy talk a little bit more about how employers are thinking about this broadly. From a technology perspective, we've seen everything from the kind of direct-to-consumer pure mobile app approaches that we've probably all seen, from little bedtime reminders, ways to change the light on your screen, trackers, noise silencers, that sort of thing, to trackers getting a little bit more advanced, things that are really about tracking your movement and the temperature and other sort of sensors that you can put in your bed and your pillow, on your phone or on your body with a Fitbit or a Jawbone sort of device, and a lot of innovation to try to help those devices be better fit for sleeping, to some of the technologies that are meant more to address some of the root causes. I believe Nancy just alluded to some of these, but the root causes can include different patterns that you have in your life, different things that you are doing around your bedtime and in your life that really need to be identified and then give you tools to address them. So cognitive behavioral therapy is one commonly accepted way of approaching those challenges, where that therapy is longstanding, well-accepted, typically has in the past been delivered one-to-one by a clinician to a patient. And in that, looking at how you can help a patient identify what are some of those things in your environment and then some of the issues that you are dealing with in terms of anxiety or other issues that you're causing for yourself. Mm-hmm. So the cognitive behavioral therapy helps to address that. And there's a number of companies that are starting to look at how do you provide cognitive behavioral therapy digitally. So we're investors in one of those called Big Health. They make a product called Sleepio that is focused on insomnia. There's a number of other companies that are focused more broadly on cognitive behavioral therapy. And we, as investors, look at some of the products that go beyond just addressing some of the symptoms and look at how you can clinically prove the validity of your offering.
So it sounds like the first step is these trackers that you're talking about, where you just have to get some sort of device that monitors how you're sleeping during the night before you can even figure out where the issues might be. And so how do these trackers work? Are they uncomfortable? What do you do with that information? How do you know if this information is, you know, is going to be useful to you? Curious, having not used one or known anyone who has used one, how it works.
Yeah, I think there's really a range of things. There's everything from just apps that you will allow you to place your phone on the bed and use the phone, your smartphone's ability to track movement and other uses of the phone sensors to give you feedback on what's happening during the night that you may not be aware of. There are chest straps that will give you biofeedback throughout the night. There's a company called To Breathe that's making that and allows for just that tracking of what's going on with your body and then reacting to it. So it is not just the diagnostic, but also some treatment in response to it. And then the bed sensors are basically embellishing and going beyond what you can do with a phone alone. So really looking at things like temperature and other indications that that you can look at your sleep patterns in terms of how you move in the night and identify the other factors that are contributing to what may be waking you up. And these are the group at KP Ventures hasn't focused too much on the trackers because they haven't been as used in clinical practice, and they haven't sort of crossed that line from the pure consumer use into how they might be used in a clinical setting, other than in sleep labs and more acute settings. So there's a lot of innovation going on that will help folks take the step beyond just using their phone and sort of the shortcomings that might have to just better understand their sleep and get some initial feedback.
And Nancy Rothstein, we just heard from you that these devices, technology is making our sleep worse, and yet now we've got these trackers that seem to rely on the very technology that may be interfering with our sleep. What's your take on the use of these tracking devices?
Well, I'm really, you know, it's so interesting to see, and I get calls constantly from companies trying to look at this device and that device. And the first thing I ask is, whether you're wearing, you know, a Fitbit or you've got, you know, one of these other trackers with a chest strap, and I've tried them, and this one in your bed, one of the first questions I ask is, this information that you're receiving from these devices changing your sleep habits? Is it helping you prepare for bedtime? Is it helping you transition from a busy day and all of the barrage of information you get on your devices? Is it doing, if it's doing that and the information you get is helping you change your behavior so that you can really prepare for sleep and transition to sleep well and find the peace you need to wind down from a busy day, great. But if you're sitting there with one of these devices, and I'm a perfect example, one of them I tried in the morning while I was waiting for the information to download and looking at my sleep number for the day, and of course I'm going to start to look at texts or emails. So the conundrum here is, if you've got all of these devices, you know, cued to your phone, it gets you to focus on other things besides whatever it is that you need to look at, not to mention the blue light considerations and the impact of lights that we didn't evolve to process, which impact the release of our melatonin, which is the sleep hormone. You know, it sounds all so complicated, and I guess I could go on about this, but it's really, we've lost the simplicity of sleep. And so, like, my bottom line on all of this is, if one of these devices is helping you sleep better and the information it provides is helping you improve poor sleep habits, then terrific. But if it's stimulating you and getting you to be, you know, in competition with yourself from day to day about how much sleep you, deep sleep you had, if the device is even correct on assessing that. I mean, really, a polysomnogram, which is the study one has if they're in a sleep lab, that's going to really give you the most thorough, correct information.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like these smartphones then could be a gateway to actually more challenges if they're not managed correctly.
Ethan, can I just say
sure.
one thing? I could put it in a nutshell. Recharge your devices out of the bedroom mm-hmm. so you can recharge in bed.
All right.
It's
pretty
simple.
I hope listeners can remember that one. It sounds pretty memorable. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the importance of sleep to our health and how new technologies might or might not help us get a better night's sleep. We're joined by Liz Rocket, a director with KP Ventures, Dr. Cleet Kushida, a neurologist and medical director of the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, and Nancy Rothstein, the sleep ambassador and director of Circadian Corporate Sleep Programs. So we're opening the phone lines, and we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you changed your approach to sleep lately? And if so, why? What prevents you from getting a good night's sleep? And do you have questions for our guests about how to improve your sleep? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org or on our Facebook page, where we're monitoring those as we speak. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, let's go to the phones. We have Steve from San Francisco calling in. Steve.
Hi there. What a great program, especially at this time of year when we got long days and short nights. So it's really tough to be able to get a full night's sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Would the panel talk about the influence of the wavelength of our devices, the specific screens that we use, the kind of blue light that comes off of there, if that's used by our bed partners and the way that that influences it as opposed to just a standard light if we're reading a book, and then also about, especially in this area, we are coffee shops on every corner at least, and the influence of caffeine.
Mm-hmm. So great question, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. And I agree, it's a good time to
great
have this
show.
Conversation with
yeah.
With the solstice and then also getting close to bedtime now for some
people. You got
people.
It.
So Dr. Kushida, why don't I direct that question to you about the wavelengths from the blue lights from these screens, but also the impact of caffeine. What do you tell your patients around this stuff?
Yes. So getting bright light at night, especially for a person that has some degree of insomnia, definitely can reset their internal clock, making it difficult for the person to fall asleep when desired. And blue wavelength of light that's emitted by things like smartphones, tablets, computers, also can reset the clock in the same way. So if you get the bright light or the blue wavelength of light at night near bedtime, it can actually make your ability to fall asleep more difficult. Nowadays, a lot of the smartphones and tablets do have blue blocking software that you can either purchase or obtain free that can block some of those blue wavelengths of light. Interestingly, research conducted at Stanford has actually shown that even the amount of light that's provided can also help reset the clock, meaning that even brief millisecond flashes of light can also it might also reset the clock. So we tell the patients to avoid any bright light and blue wavelengths of light at night, especially if they have difficulty falling asleep. Secondly, the caffeine that you mentioned, yes, it's definitely known that these days there's a proliferation of caffeine and caffeinated drinks, but it's not necessarily a bad thing in the sense that there is no substitute for a good night's sleep, but there are some countermeasures for sleep. So if a person hasn't had a good night's sleep the night before, having caffeine can sometimes bring the person's performance and neurocognition back to baseline levels. I don't obviously recommend, you know, it on a continual basis, but caffeine in some circumstances can actually help to act as a countermeasure for poor sleep. Mm. Obviously, those individuals that get heavy doses of caffeine on a regular basis, there's other health concerns to worry about, but caffeine might not be such a bad thing if it's used in like any other type of medication or intervention used as a countermeasure might not be bad.
Well, I'm sure a lot of listeners who enjoy coffee or tea in the morning are probably happy to hear that, as long as I'm sure they're using it responsibly and in a managed kind of way. Steve, thank you for that question. I want to go back to the phones. Sherry, welcome to City Visions.
I wonder if there was any research in relation to this, that when I sleep at night on my left side, when I'm more quiet, I can hear the heart pumping and it seems strained versus sleeping on the right-hand side, and that seems a more relaxed pumping through the heart, and it seems more relaxed position to me. Is there anything in your studies about the stress on the heart when you're sleeping?
Yeah, sure. That's an interesting question. Actually, Dr. Kushida, why don't I go back to you with that one, and then maybe let Nancy Rothstein weigh in after you have a chance to respond. But thank you for that question, Sherry.
Yes, I don't believe there's evidence indicating either the right side or the left side makes a large difference in terms of function of the heart. We do know that for sleep disordered breathing, for instance, obstructive apnea, sleeping on the sides is actually better than sleeping on the back, because in a majority of cases, people that have sleep apnea, it's worse when they lie on their back. If they do lie on their back, we also recommend tilting the head of the bed 30 degrees if they have sleep apnea. But in answer to your question, I don't know of any literature indicating left versus right side sleeping is better or worse for the heart.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And Nancy Rothstein, I wanted to also direct that question to you. If you hear, as you consult with different people who have sleep issues, if you hear similar questions around sleeping on one side versus the other, and what your response might be.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify, I have an MBA after my name, not an MD, so I really don't address medical issues. But for you, Sherry, if this is something you are self-aware of, that sleeping on your left side, you can hear your heart, and then on the right is more relaxed, then that's what you should do. There have been some things. There was something out of Harvard I read about, and I'm not going to say exactly what it is because I'm not specifically sure at this moment, but for certain women, particularly when pregnant, sleeping on one side or the other may be more complementary, more helpful for the, for the organs. But for the most part, it's really what you're comfortable doing and making sure that the way you're sleeping, that you've got a good, fine mattress that, and it is an investment, and it's an important one, that has pressure point relief, that you've got a pillow that your head is aligned with your spine, as opposed to, too big a pillow sleeping on your side so your neck is torqued, or too thin a pillow so your neck is also not aligned at a good, angle with your shoulder. So those are all very important things. But what I really think is terrific is that you're even aware of this. And so, if you prefer sleeping, I know that I prefer sleeping on my left side for the most part. So it really depends on the individual. As Dr. Kushida said, there's not something specific that he's aware of research on this. But again, it becomes what's most comfortable for you, short of any, medical-related disorder.
So thank you, Sherry, again for that question. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the importance of sleep to our health and how new technologies may or may not help us get a better night's sleep. We're joined by Liz Rocket, director with KP Ventures, Dr. Cleet Kushida, neurologist at Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, and Nancy Rothstein, the sleep ambassador and director of Circadian Corporate Sleep Programs. We invite you to continue to call in with questions or comments, the number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us right now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Also, you can reach us by tweeting us on Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. We have another caller, Ed. Welcome to City Visions. Ed from Menlo Park. What is your question tonight?
Good evening. I'm a blind individual with quite a bit of pain in back and joints, etc., and I use an extended-release Tylenol and also an extended-release 10-milligram melatonin, and I only get 4 hours of sleep if I'm lucky, generally. And I was wondering if any of these devices would be useful to me in gathering information. Are they accessible to me as a blind individual, meaning the device and the app associated with it? And is the information private once it is gathered, or does it go somewhere where maybe I'm not comfortable with it going?
Mm-hmm. So Ed, these are great questions. Let me direct this one to Liz Rocket, who invests in many of these companies and looks into these technologies and the privacy issues and everything else you're mentioning. So Liz, do you have a response for Ed on this question?
Yeah, Ed, I think there are a few companies that have started to look at how to innovate around chronic pain, specifically focused on the effects on sleep. It's still a pretty nascent area. We haven't seen a ton of innovation focused here. But I know that there's one company called Quell that's made an electrostimulation band that's meant to help with chronic pain, specifically around sleep, and another one called Sauna that's focused on a sleep mask. And I'm sure the nature of the pain that you're managing is going to change whether or not either of these devices is useful for you. And I'd be curious to hear Dr. Kishida's thoughts in terms of other devices that he might have seen. But I do think, just on the topic of how information is shared and what gets captured and collected, it's an important question to ask, especially for some of these things that are provided directly to a consumer rather than through your employer, through your insurer, or through your healthcare system. If this is something that you're getting through the healthcare system, there's typically been a lot of vetting done to make sure that any device or tracking system is protecting your health information and making sure that your health information is only shared with those that you choose to share it with. But that process is called HIPAA vetting. Big systems will do that, but certainly if you're buying something directly yourself, you'd want to ask those questions of the company.
And Ed, let me also throw your question to Dr. Kishida. Dr. Kishida, do you want to respond to Ed's questions as well?
Yes. I'm not aware of any devices that can be used, for tracking sleep in non-sighted individuals. One issue that does come up that we see quite a bit of is circadian rhythms that are the sleep-wake cycle rhythms that are altered for people that are non-sighted. So one of the things is that there are some newer medications, such as this one called Tasmeltion, that can help to synchronize the internal clock and provide better sleep in people that don't have a sustained sleep-wake cycle because of the because of the non-sightedness. Additionally, there are some medications that can be very effective in treating pain syndromes, provided that the root cause of the pain can't be effectively treated. There are some medications that can serve as both pain relief, but also can enhance some stages of sleep, including the deeper stages of sleep. So, if it does become a consistent problem where you're only getting about 4 hours of sleep and feeling very sleepy during the daytime, I would really encourage you to check with your primary care physician or a sleep specialist.
Great. Well, thank you, Ed, again for that question. Hopefully that advice is helpful for others who suffer from the same symptoms. I want to go back to the phones. Ruth Ann, welcome back to City Visions, Ruth Ann. Oh, we might have lost Ruth Ann, so we're going to go to next caller. We have Karen from Berkeley. Karen, welcome to City Visions.
Good evening. So I know that we as human beings are electromagnetic creatures. When we go to the doctor, they give us an EKG, which if that flat lines or blue lines, that means we're dead. But otherwise, you get a reading on the EKG machine showing that electrically you're alive. So all of the electromagnetic beeps and broadcasts that are coming from cell towers, cell phones, smart cars, smart this, smart lights, are bombarding us with other electromagnetic currents. And I wanted to know what your guests think about the interference that we are, the electromagnetic interference that we get. Personally, when I go to work, I take my cell phone and wrap it in tinfoil. And when I go to sleep at night, I wrap it in tinfoil and don't even sleep with it in my room because it was recommended that that would help me get better sleep.
Well, Karen, I think your question might be perfectly suited for Nancy Rothstein, given that she was talking about the impact of technology. Nancy, do you hear comments like this, and what is your typical response?
Well, I do hear. This is somewhat of a new one. Although personally, you know, I've been given plugs to put into my electrical outlets in the house to minimize this frequency and that frequency. And I'm not a master of it, but I have to certainly think that there's something going on that we probably haven't really researched enough or really know the impact of all this electromagnetic frequencies on our biorhythms, on our bodies. Just having come from some NIH meetings that Dr. Kushida was at with me in the Sleep Disorder Research Advisory Board, and we talk about what research needs to go on in the field of sleep, and this is something certainly that over time I hope we will look at more research. But in the short term, you know, there are some devices, and there's one that's a sleep bracelet, actually, that has something called electromagnetic frequency technology to sync our bodies in line with their natural rhythms. But, you know, there's not enough research on some of these devices to say if there are a difference or what's the baseline to know what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're smart to say, you know, I'm not going to take a risk with this. I'm going to get my cell phone out of the bedroom at night.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that for many reasons. So aside from the frequency is also the stimulation that when you start looking at it or the blue light. So I can't really answer your question specifically, but I think you're on to something, and if you find a way that you're comfortable with, I think that's terrific.
Yeah, so definitely precautionary principle if you're concerned about the impact of all these devices. So thank you, Karen, for that question. So Anna, you're on the phones now. Welcome to City Visions, and do you have a question for the panel?
It's not so much a question, but the person who originally called about EMF and sleep, it's related to that. I got radiated by one smart meter 7 years ago, got him to take it off. I had all the radiation symptoms in spades. I got him to take it off the building. It left me electrically sensitive. I can tell you that if you look at emfsafetynetwork.org, you can learn all you need to know about radiation from all of the EMF that is just more layers of it every day. Also, the sun, moon, and earth run on 7.83 hertz, and with all of the many more layers every day of 5G is coming. It's even stronger. It's beamed down on the earth from satellites. It travels. One smart meter's frequencies go for 2 miles, even through brick walls, and damage the DNA in every living thing.
So, Anna, I'm gonna have to cut you off because I think you made a point that probably a lot of people, you know, might share, and I'd like to get a chance to give a panelist an opportunity to respond. But thank you for calling in with that comment. So, Liz, why don't I ask you about that? Since you're dealing with technology and how it affects people's sleep, do you often have people who express these concerns around, do I really want to have this tracking device? Is this going to interfere with me and kind of defeat the purpose and the other devices that people would use while they're sleeping? Do you hear these kinds of concerns a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I think the devices and trackers are really one option and can be part of a good solution for folks looking to learn more about their sleep. But certainly there's a lot of side effects to be considered. And I think we see even the most basic innovation as research comes out that shows the impact of blue light and the impact of, as Nancy's been articulating, just the stimulation of these devices and the way that we use them that isn't yet informed by research. So there is a need for a lot more research to just better understand how all of this is affecting us, but then also innovation from the companies that are trying to produce products to help us. So looking at how they can take advantage of what you can do during the day. I've mentioned just cognitive behavioral therapy as one approach where it's less about what you do right before bed or when you wake up at night, and more how you track what's going on and learn from it during the day. So there is some tracking that might go on at night, but the therapy itself is really delivered in a 16-week course mm-hmm. to help you just learn better about it. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that a lot of what we report as a sleep issue is linked to other stress, emotional health, and sort of mental health and wellness issues. And that is driving a lot of the interest that we see in it, where folks are looking for a way to just understand what's going on with their body, and it expresses during sleep. So that's one of the, you may have to introduce a tracker to the bedroom to understand your sleep, but likely in pursuing that and learning how to better address some of the issues with your sleep, you may better understand some of the rest of your emotional health and stress levels.
And so that it's more of a daytime project to help your nighttime sleeping.
Could I respond to something that I thought was so important that Liz just said?
Sure, Nancy, go ahead.
I think when she just said things that happen during the day are expressed or expresses during sleep is really so on target. Life is a 24/7 operation. And we sleep for about a third of our lives. Most of us have never taken a course on sleep and know little about it. But much of what we are doing the day is expressing itself in the anxiety, making it difficult to go to sleep, or waking up during the night and waking up unrefreshed. So it's really important to look not just at what's happening during your sleep or, you know, certainly, but really looking also what are you doing during the day that can color and impact the quality of your sleep. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, good guidance for those who have struggled with sleeping issues. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing the importance of sleep to our health tonight and how new technologies may or may not help us get a better night's sleep. We're joined by Liz Rocket from KP Ventures, Dr. Cleet Kushida from Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, and Nancy Rothstein, director of the Circadian Corporate Sleep Programs. We invite you to continue to call in with questions or comments for this last 20 minutes or so that we have. The number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. I want to go to the phones. We have Peter dialing in. Peter, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I suffer from sleep apnea, and my question is about the kind of vocal therapies that you know, you can learn about on YouTube, say, or about whether they might work. And and really, as a trailer to that, where are reputable places to learn about therapies and to learn more about sleep issues? Mm-hmm.
So, Peter, that's a great question to direct to Dr. Kushida. Dr. Kushida, what do you say to people who ask questions about where to get help for sleep apnea?
Yes. Yeah, so to find the best resources in your area, one good place to go is to go to the website sleepeducation.org. Also, sleepcenters.org, you can actually type in your zip code and then find a neighboring sleep center in your area. These sites are maintained by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which is our main professional organization for sleep medicine. So that's one resource. And you also asked about voice therapy for sleep apnea. There are some reports that have been published about using wind instruments to increase the tone of the upper aorial muscles to reduce the severity of sleep apnea, and some of these reports have shown a positive influence, you know, for sleep apnea. There's also this other thing called myofunctional therapy that was initially developed for people that were recovering from stroke in order to have them retain their ability to resume their ability to speak. And some of those techniques have been applied towards the treatment of sleep apnea. So both of these areas are kind of emerging fields of sleep apnea, but reports from both of those areas have shown to be have shown some benefit in improving sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm. Great. So thank you, Peter, for that phone call. We have an email from Sufi who asks, I have teens who go to bed late because of social lives and they sleep with devices nearby. Any advice specifically for parents of teens? Dr. Kushida, do you get patients asking about teenagers and how to help them get a better night's sleep and what you can do as parents to help them?
Yeah, so absolutely. We encourage them, the parents, to limit the use of electronic devices close to bedtime. We also encourage trying to keep a consistent bedtime and awakening time. Most of the time, children and adolescents have sort of a natural delay sleep phase, meaning that they want to sleep later and get up later. So, sometimes it's just not feasible if they have homework and early school start times. But in general, we try to encourage them to maximize their sleep at night and to limit the bright light, the smartphone use. There is a movement right now to delay the school start times, which hopefully will gain traction nationwide so that the adolescents and children won't be forced to have to go to school at a time when their brains aren't optimal in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I would love to
sure. Nancy Rostein, go ahead, answer that.
Thank you. First of all, I'm up in the Maine woods at a girls' camp where I went many decades ago, and I'm here helping out. And there's no lights in the cabins. There's no hot water. It's very rustic. And the girls relinquish all of their devices, their cell phones, and their iPads and everything when they get to camp. So I am watching 150 girls go to sleep every night. They're tired, but they're not wired because they're not wired. And it is so fascinating to watch and observe that they can relinquish it all, but how well they sleep and how easily they fall asleep when they're not exposed to all of the devices. So I think that's really possible, but asking a teen to put away their phone at home or turn it all off, and even if the parents say it's lest they put them in another room and they're all sort of locked away together, is really difficult because that's how they grow up. But another case in point, which was fascinating, is I've been consulting to LinkedIn, and we had sleep fairs for nearly 1,000 employees in both New York office and in Dublin, their European headquarters. And we suggested that everybody put away their phones an hour before bed and gave them an analog clock without any LED lights and all of that. And within days, their wellness group was getting emails about how, oh, my God, I'm sleeping so much better. I can't believe the difference. So it's very, very hard to transition because they've grown up with these devices and they're really a part of their lives. But if somehow teens understood more about what actually happens, the science of sleep, what actually, even adults, the parents knew, what happens to the brain during sleep? What's going on? How do we rejuvenate? I truly believe if we had a better understanding, and certainly teens did and even children, had a better understanding and appreciation of it, they might be actually tempted to do an experiment. Let me see what it's like if I don't do all this before bed.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like some good advice then for teenagers and their parents to take into account some of these steps. So let's go to the phone lines once again. We have Carol calling in. Carol, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I wanted to say right out that the thing that I did to help me solve my sleep problem, and I was having significant problems getting enough sleep, is that I found an app which is interestingly based on cognitive psychology, and it's called My Sleep Button, and it works on, I think, on both the the Apple and Android. But I was having a terrible time. At postmenopausal, I couldn't get to sleep. I had been a deep sleeper, and I couldn't get to sleep. And I was just frantic because sleep is so important. And I did everything that we were talking about, which is go to sleep at a regular time. I stopped drinking caffeine after afternoon. Gave up reading 1 or 2 hours before, just about everything that I could think of, including using a sleep mask, which really helped. That was one of the big breakthroughs because it keeps everything dark in a regular, consistent way. But I still was having trouble, and so I discovered that this sleep app, which is based on, as I said, cognitive psychology, it really makes a difference. And so I suddenly am able to get real, true sleep, and I happen to stay asleep. So it's like transformed my life again. Cool. So I think that some of these things, if you find something that works with what your problem is, as I did, then all of a sudden I'm back to having good sleep. And I did one thing because I'm also concerned about the radio waves, and I don't think it's a worry that is insignificant. And so I did I know it seems funny, but I built my own little Faraday cage out of used wine box liners, which is it's like an aluminum liner, but it does keep the keep the phone from getting any kind of outside radio waves at night.
So, Carol, I'm sorry to cut you off. I think you're describing something that a few other callers have done as well, to cut off these radio waves. But I want to give Liz Rocket a chance to respond to your comment. And first of all, thank you for sharing this successful approach that you've taken to solving your sleep issues. Liz, I'm sure it's probably something you hear a lot, that people find these apps, this cognitive behavioral therapy that people can do. What is your response to Carol and people like her who have these successes?
Yeah, well, first, I think Carol and a few others of your callers are indicative of the Bay Area culture of innovation. They will find a way to provide for what the devices can and may not work with. But just first, for those who may not be familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy, just a quick word on what it is. It's a short-term, goal-oriented form of psychotherapy. And it's a very pragmatic form of therapy. So the idea here is to identify patterns of thinking or behavior that are contributing to something you want to stop or address. It's a pretty broad-based therapy, so it can work quite well for insomnia. It's also used for anxiety, depression, and a number of other mental health challenges. So it is something that, taking this approach, is typically used to just help understand what's going on. It's great, Carol, to hear that My Sleep Button worked for you. I know that within the Kaiser Permanente Ventures team, we're focused on looking for the folks who have done the work to prove out through clinical trials that what they're offering is clinically efficacious. Cognitive behavioral therapy is well known, well trusted, but trying to convert it to a virtual delivery is something that needed to be tested. And so I mentioned that we invested in a company called Big Health with their Sleepio product. They ran a placebo-controlled, randomized control trial, got it published in a peer-reviewed journal called Sleep, and they showed there that people fell asleep 54% faster. They reduced those midnight wake-ups, if that was their issue, by nearly two-thirds. And the interesting thing here, and this is what the founder of the company, Peter Hames, will always say, so he struggled with insomnia. That's why he developed the app initially and started his journey to creating this company. But he'll say that sleep is really the Trojan horse of the mental health issues. So if you're dealing with something like anxiety and depression, you may not be comfortable talking to your doctor or really anybody about it. But we do have, as was mentioned at the top of the hour, a real comfort with saying, oh, I can't sleep. I never sleep well. And so identifying insomnia as something you're struggling with is easier for folks in our culture. And that makes addressing insomnia through something like cognitive behavioral therapy a real Trojan horse. It's something that can kind of cut through some of the stigma and things that prevent us from addressing other things. And we've seen through the randomized control trials that Big Health did with Sleepio, these apps can have a big impact on folks' sleep.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kushida, you know, we were talking about this earlier, but I'm interested in your response to all this new technology innovation, the use of apps. I mean, you've been in this field for a long time, and, you know, I'm sure when you started out, these apps weren't available. What is your take as a medical professional looking at this sort of plethora of options that are now out there and getting funded?
Well, first of all, anything that increases knowledge about sleep is a good thing, and whether it's the self-tracking devices or just reading about sleep, you know, in general, it's a positive thing because it makes people realize, you know, if they are having are not having good sleep. So it's a positive thing. Secondly, I think that the field is emerging and really exploding exponentially because our research lab actually tests a lot of these devices because of our proximity next to Silicon Valley. And what we notice is that by the time we finish testing a device, a new prototype is already available from the same company. So their product cycles are so quick that it would be no surprise that in a couple of years, these devices will very accurately be able to measure sleep as well as measure the type of sleep and other, parameters about sleep. So I believe, those are the basic things that, it's good to inform more information that people have on their fingertips about sleep is a positive thing. And then down the road, probably in about 5 years, these devices will be very accurate to the point that they'll be able to really pinpoint their amount of sleep and type of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to thank you for that, and I wanted to close with a comment that we got on Twitter, and this person says this probably isn't solvable, but for many single people, falling asleep alone isn't as easy as falling asleep with a partner. And Nancy Rothstein, I wanted to give you quickly the last word. What is your take on that? Is it easier to fall asleep when you have someone else in bed with you?
Well, it's a really funny thing you should ask because I was just interviewed for an article about women are scared to fall asleep alone, and I thought to myself, really? And then I read a few articles, and then I said, well, I do sometimes when I'm alone, like in a hotel room or a dark house alone, and it's a very typical thing. It turns out, because I've been querying a lot of people, that women generally are in terms of that. In terms of the actual quality of sleep, it depends. If your spouse is snoring or your bed partner is snoring, then it's not such a great thing to be with someone. So it's a bit of a conundrum. It depends.
Yeah, I think we can hear a sigh of recognition from around the Bay Area for women who have to deal with loud snoring husbands. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it at that. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Liz Rocket, director with KP Ventures, Dr. Cleet Kushida, neurologist and medical director of the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, and Nancy Rothstein, the sleep ambassador and director of circadian corporate sleep programs. Thank you all for joining me this evening. And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download our podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. We're off next Monday for the July 4th long weekend, but join guest host Grace Wan in 2 weeks as we kick off our new series highlighting innovation in medicine in the Bay Area by exploring gender differences in the brain. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks for listening. Good night, sleep well, and have a great rest of your week. Thanks so much.